Tantor Audio, a division of Recorded Books, presents The Tuskegee Syphilis Study, an insider's account of the shocking medical experiment conducted by government doctors against African-American men, by Fred D. Gray, narrated by David Sadson. Forward. When President Clinton, in a ceremony at the White House on May 16, 1997, addressed five elderly African-American men, ages 89 to 109, and the family members of others who could not be present, he brought a symbolic resolution to one of the most shameful episodes in U.S. medical history. The President of the United States looked these men in the eyes and said, "The United States government did something that was wrong, deeply, profoundly, morally wrong. It was an outrage to our commitment to integrity and equality for all our citizens. The American people are sorry for the loss, for the years of hurt. You did nothing wrong, but you were grievously wronged. I apologize, and I am sorry that this apology has been so long in coming." As attorney for the participants in what became known as the Tuskegee Syphilis Study, I was deeply moved. Yes, in one sense it was true what the critics were saying, that the president's apology was too little and too late. Yet for these surviving men and family members, and for the conscience of the nation, it could never be too late to make amends for a terrible injustice. When someone hurts you, their telling you that they are sorry for what they did is a healing act. This is no less true when it is your government that has committed the wrong. World history teaches us that governments rarely admit moral culpability for their wrongful actions. And what had the United States government done that was so wrong? Put in its simplest terms, the government used 623 men as human guinea pigs in a misguided 40-year medical experiment. That in itself would have been bad enough. The moral and ethical injury was compounded by the fact that all of these men were African-American, predominantly poor and uneducated, and were deliberately kept in the dark about what was happening to them. It is pointless to try to weigh one person's suffering against another's, and I am not for a moment equating the Tuskegee Syphilis Study with the horrors committed in the name of science by Nazi doctors against Jews at Dachau and other places during World War II, but the principle is the same. The Nuremberg trials against Nazi war criminals resulted in a set of standards under which the civilized world agreed that human beings would not be used as research animals and that doctors would never forget that their first duty is to heal their patients. The Tuskegee Syphilis Study reiterates the necessity for commitment to these ideals. As an American citizen, it shames me to realize that the Tuskegee Syphilis Study, which began in 1932, continued under the supervision of U.S. government officials and highly trained medical professionals until 1972, more than two decades after the Nuremberg trials. Thus, as I sat on the front row in the East Room of the White House on a warm May 16, 1997, I felt the president's apology on behalf of the American people was a significant step in the right direction. Observing the ceremony, I reaffirmed my commitment to help ensure that the lessons of the Tuskegee Syphilis Study were widely known and that some lasting good will come out of the tragic situation. This book tells the inside story, the real story, of the Tuskegee Syphilis Study, the lawsuit that eventually brought some compensation to the study victims and survivors, and the events culminating in the White House apology. This book also explains the plans to create a prominent memorial and research center in Tuskegee, Alabama, as a permanent legacy of the experiment and of the rich history and culture of the area. I wrote this book because God placed me in a position to do so. My first book, Bus Ride to Justice, told how I became a civil rights lawyer after growing up in segregated Montgomery, Alabama. My hard-working mother and my supportive community encouraged me to get a college education and then go to law school, even though I had to leave my home state to find a law school that would admit Negroes, as we were then called. After graduating from Case Western Reserve Law School, I could have taken a job in Cleveland, Ohio, but I returned to Alabama, determined to destroy everything segregated I could find. At the age of 23, I became one of only two African-American attorneys in Montgomery. One of my first clients was Rosa Parks, who was arrested after she refused to give up her seat to a white man on a segregated city bus. Subsequently, I became the attorney for the Montgomery bus boycott and its inspired leader, the Reverend Dr. Martin Luther King, Jr. I worked with Martin King, Rosa Parks, E.D. Nixon, and other giants of what mushroomed into the civil rights movement. Between 1955 and 1972, I filed dozens of successful lawsuits to desegregate schools, housing, transportation, places of employment, and other areas of public life. In the mid-1960s, I moved my residence 40 miles up the road to Tuskegee, Alabama, and in 1970, I became one of the first two African Americans elected to the Alabama legislature since Reconstruction. Meanwhile, I continued to busy practice in both civil rights and more routine legal matters. I was also a full-time minister in the Church of Christ. I was involved in the community and, I believe it is fair to say, was probably the best-known African-American attorney in Alabama. Yet, until the Tuskegee syphilis study became public knowledge through news reports in 1972, I was unaware of the experiment that had existed in my community for 40 years. As far as the general public was concerned, the study had been kept a total secret. Nevertheless, when one of the men involved in the study approached me, I immediately recognized the seriousness of what had been done. The man rightfully felt, based on what was being reported in the media, that he had been mistreated and he wanted me to sue whoever was responsible. Consequently, I filed the lawsuit, and with the help of my colleagues, eventually won a settlement on behalf of all the participants in the study. Over the years, I remained in close contact with many of the surviving participants. I included a chapter on the case in Bus Ride to Justice, which was published in 1995. Then in 1997, the home box office cable television company presented the dramatic film Miss Evers' Boys, which was based on the Tuskegee syphilis study. Many of the men involved in the study were deeply offended by this movie, which they felt misrepresented them and the facts of the study. In any case, this movie and a stage play of the same name brought the case back into the media spotlight. Over a period of time, many people, including myself, realized that even though there had been a settlement in the lawsuit on behalf of the study victims, and the study itself had been ended, there were still unresolved issues that should be addressed. Gradually, the idea emerged for a public apology from the federal government to the victims of the study, including surviving participants and the families of those who had died. For several months, my late wife and I worked together on events which led to the presidential apology. Now, using case files, personal knowledge, and interviews and statements of numerous people involved in various aspects of the study, I have compiled a record which I hope will be compelling and useful listening for students, teachers, researchers, and anyone interested in understanding why and how such an episode could have happened. This book has been written in the hope that the past will not be forgotten and that this type of occurrence will never happen again. It has been said that those who forget the past are condemned to repeat it. I love my country, and I believe that, through the help of God, the long pendulum of history is slowly swinging in the direction of justice and equality. Nonetheless, the history of African Americans has been too painful to repeat, so we had best remember and remember well. Fred D. Gray, Tuskegee, Alabama. 1. Introduction. In July 1972, while flying from Washington, D.C. home to Montgomery, I was reading the newspaper when my eye was caught by an article about a medical experiment in my adopted hometown of Tuskegee, Alabama. The article, by Associated Press reporter Gene Heller, described how the study was initiated by the United States Public Health Service in 1932 with the intent of collecting data about the effects of untreated syphilis. According to the article, the study used as subjects some 600 African-American males from the rural areas in and around Macon County, of which Tuskegee is the county seat. More than half of the 623 men had syphilis. The others, a control group, did not. Over the next few days, additional articles and broadcast reports provided more details. These reports floored me for several reasons. I was shocked to learn that the study had been going on for 40 years. I was born and reared in an adjacent county, and I started handling cases in Macon County soon after I passed the Alabama bar exam and hung out my shingle in 1954. I had opened a law office in Tuskegee in 1958, had been living there since 1965, and had represented the county in the state legislature. Tuskegee is not a big place. In 1972, the population of the county was only 25,000, and I had probably shaken the hands of half of them. Yet I had never heard of the Tuskegee syphilis study. It was astounding to me that such a study could have avoided public discussion for 40 years. I later learned that the medical research community was quite familiar with the study, but that certainly was not the case with the general public. Secondly, the news story, brief as it was, outlined what could only be viewed as an alarming atrocity, and yet another example of racial injustices perpetrated by government in segregated Alabama. In this case, not by the state of Alabama, but by the federal government. Syphilis is an equal opportunity disease. It can be transmitted from black or white genitals just the same, and it equally ravages black or white neural systems, brains, hearts, and other organs. Yet each of the 623 study subjects was an African-American male. Furthermore, they were predominantly poor, uneducated, and, in rural Alabama in 1932, would have been extremely unsophisticated about medical treatment in general. As I said, I was shocked, but I was hardly surprised. I had witnessed many areas where African Americans had been treated unjustly. This case was simply especially appalling because it was officially sanctioned by the federal government and involved life or death situations for several hundred United States citizens. Thirdly, effective treatment was knowingly and systematically withheld from those suffering from a potentially fatal disease. Putting aside the apparent problems with how the participants were selected, one could see the original rationale behind the study, for when it began in the 30s, there was no effective cure for syphilis. But by the 1940s, penicillin had been discovered and found to be highly effective as a treatment for syphilis. By the end of World War II, penicillin was a readily available and relatively inexpensive cure for syphilis. Yet for another two decades, officials in charge of this study deliberately withheld treatment from the diseased majority of its participants. I thought it was a tragedy that these poor rural men in my county had suffered such an injustice. On July 27, 1972, Mr. Charlie Pollard, a Macon County farmer, came into my office and asked if I had read about the men who were involved in the tests for bad blood. He said he was one of the men. He then related that a few days before, he was at a stockyard in Montgomery, and a newspaper woman found him and engaged him in a conversation about his involvement in a health program in Tuskegee since back in the 30s. The reporter was asked if he knew Eunice Rivers, the nurse who worked with the men in the testing program from the beginning to end. He stated that he did. Mr. Pollard related to me in detail his involvement. His statement confirmed the news reports I had been reading and watching on television. As a result of our discussion, I agreed to represent Mr. Pollard in a lawsuit against the government and any others we might discover who were legally responsible for operating and maintaining the study. That is how I became involved as the attorney for the plaintiffs in what became known as Pollard v. United States of America, a class action lawsuit filed in federal court in Montgomery. In the following chapters, I will tell the story of the Tuskegee Syphilis Study, beginning with some background about Macon County. This background is necessary to understanding the time period and setting of the study, the origins and methodology of the study itself, and the filing of the lawsuit, its supporting investigation, the judicial settlement that resulted, and the follow-up legal efforts to locate the participants and their heirs in order to pay them their part of the settlement. Then I will relate some of what has happened to these men and their case in the years since, especially the renewed media attention of recent years, as well as the unprecedented events of May 1997, when the President of the United States met with some of the study survivors at the White House and publicly apologized to them on behalf of the nation. Finally, I will describe the proposal to build a memorial center in Tuskegee as a legacy to the study participants and to those of all races, particularly Native Americans, European Americans, and African Americans, who have contributed to the unique history and culture of Tuskegee and Macon County, Alabama. This legacy includes legislative and regulatory actions to make sure that such a thing as the Tuskegee Syphilis Study cannot happen again. 2. Macon County, Alabama. A person who was not living in Tuskegee in Macon County in 1932 can hardly imagine what life was like at that time and place. It is hard even for me, and I was born in 1930 in Montgomery, the adjacent county southwest of Macon. To begin with, there were vast material differences. That was long before automatic transmissions in automobiles, televisions, and most of the modern conveniences that we take for granted today. Very few people had ever flown in an airplane. No one had ever heard of an interstate highway. In Macon County, and similar rural parts of the Deep South in 1932, most people did not have plumbing, electricity, telephones, and cars, all of which are considered necessities of life now. It truly was a different world then. Beyond the material, there were the differences in society and culture. Of course, when I speak to school children today, I am always a little startled by the realization that almost two generations have now reached adulthood in Alabama with no personal knowledge of colored water fountains, Jim Crow public accommodations, racial restrictions on voting and jury service, and so forth. This is not to say that all racial problems have been solved, but simply to acknowledge that the South of today is light years from what it was in 1932. The part of Alabama which extends from East Central Alabama, where Macon County is located, on through Montgomery, Lowndes, Wilcox, Dallas, Sumter, Greene, and Pickens counties to the Mississippi line is called the Black Belt. All of these counties have a majority black population, and many people think the Black Belt is called that because of its demographics. The name was actually bestowed by geologists because of the area's rich, dark soil composition. Nevertheless, while the dark soil was exceptionally fertile, its richness was realized largely through the labor of dark Alabamians. Coincidentally, the name of my publisher, Black Belt Press, is also derived from this region of Alabama, which is well known for its distinctive geographic and sociopolitical characteristics. Because most people outside Alabama associate black belts with martial arts, Black Belt Press prints an explanatory statement in every book it publishes. This statement is a good summary of the culture of the place and hints at the societal extremes. It was and is a place of great beauty, of extreme wealth and grinding poverty, of pain and joy, which have existed virtually since Alabama became a state in 1819. As a center of cotton culture, the Black Belt had a high African-American population from the time the first European settlers arrived, bringing with them African slaves. Some of the richest land in Macon County had been a part of the Creek Nation until the Sessions of 1832. After the removal of the Indians, another tragic episode in American history, planters and slaves poured into the area. This was a result of the Indian Removal Act of 1830, which authorized the president to negotiate with the Indian tribes east of the Mississippi River for the purchase of their land. The Choctaw, Creek, Tuskegee, Eufaula, Coosa, Alabama, Coweta, Cushita, and other Native American tribes and languages had been early occupants of what is now the state of Alabama. Ultimately, many Indians were isolated far from their fertile homelands on barren, barely habitable land in various desolate areas of the western United States. Prosperity in Macon County did not last, however, because by 1850 the harsh agricultural practices of the time had farmed out some of the best cropland. Between the agricultural decline and the upheaval of the Civil War, Macon County actually lost population in the middle third of the 19th century. Still, after emancipation, most of the former slaves stayed in the area and continued to till the soil as sharecroppers or tenant farmers or simply as hired laborers for the white landowners. By 1930, Macon County's population was 27,103, of which 22,320 were African American. According to government statistics, the average income in Macon County was only $1 to $2 a day. The 1940 census showed that there were 5,205 farm-dwelling units in the county, of which 4,500 were in need of major repairs, had no running water, no electricity, and no toilet within the structure. In other words, conditions were bad in Macon County in 1932. There were only two incorporated towns, Tuskegee and Notasauga. The Great Depression had begun, and it was harder than ever to earn a living. Racial conditions in Alabama. Another very important element which must be considered is the racial climate in Alabama from 1932 to 1954. At that time, in Alabama and throughout the South, everything was rigidly segregated based on race. The laws of the state of Alabama required the complete separation of whites and blacks in public accommodations and in almost all other aspects of life. The United States Supreme Court held in the case of Plessy v. Ferguson, 1896, that the state of Louisiana could segregate passengers by race on trains traveling in that state so long as the facilities were substantially equal. This was the beginning of the doctrine of separate but equal, though in practice the result was separate but unequal, because facilities provided for coloreds rarely, if ever, were the same as those provided for whites. In 1938, the court extended that doctrine to education in the case of Gaines v. Canada, ex relatione. We were thus plagued with separate but equal until May 17, 1954. On that day, the Supreme Court held in Brown v. Board of Education that separate educational facilities were inherently unequal and that the doctrine of separate but equal had no place in the field of education. However, when the study started, segregation was the law of the land. In addition, during the beginning and extending into the early phase of the study, African Americans were still being lynched with sickening regularity. The lives of African Americans in Alabama during that period of time were not worth very much. It was during this time also that the infamous Scottsboro Boys case was making headlines in Alabama and across the nation. This is a case in which two white women accused several African Americans of raping them in North Alabama. Ultimately, in a trial which legal experts have considered biased and based on suspect evidence, the accused were convicted and given life sentences. Several died in prison. One, late in life, was granted a pardon. The point is that given the racial conditions of the day, it was not difficult for the average white person in Alabama to participate in the study of untreated syphilis on African American men. Tuskegee Institute. Because of the existence of Tuskegee Institute, led by Booker T. Washington, there were a larger-than-average number of well-educated, what would now be called middle-class, African-Americans living in Tuskegee. Yet most of the African-Americans in Macon County were not middle-class professionals. Most were farmers, a few on their own land, but usually on land owned by the white minority. This was still a cotton culture, and cotton culture throughout the Deep South was originally based on slavery and then on tenancy and sharecropping. By the time the Tuskegee syphilis study began in 1932, Professor George Washington Carver had already made Tuskegee Institute even more famous by his scientific experiments in agriculture, particularly in developing many uses for peanuts and sweet potatoes. As Robert J. Norrell writes in his book, Reaping the Whirlwind, about Tuskegee's civil rights history, Carver's work had not yet changed the dominant agricultural model in Macon County. The Institute's efforts to improve farming practices apparently benefited black farmers in Macon County only marginally. Charles S. Johnson, the prominent sociologist at Fisk University, surveyed 612 black farm families in the county in the early 1930s and found that little had changed for the better for black farmers since the end of slavery. Indeed, many things had gotten worse. Land ownership had declined relentlessly. More and more black farmers had become sharecroppers, deepening their dependence on white landlords. 90% of those surveyed were tenants. They all told him the same thing. Sharecropping allowed almost no room for blacks to improve themselves. They managed to live on advances, Johnson wrote, or by borrowing for food and clothing and permitting their crop to be taken in satisfaction of the debt. For the black tenant, there was very little of the independence that Booker Washington had envisioned. "When you're working on a white man's place," one man told Johnson, "you have to do what he says, or treat, trade, or travel." The tenant system belied the earlier faith in the curative power of education for blacks. Johnson discovered that black men with more than an elementary education were likely to quit farming altogether. The most successful tenant farmers were those with a bare minimum of education, the ones literate enough to make the best of the situation, but not so well educated as to view it as intolerable. This was a brutal economic model. That sharecroppers were not far removed from slavery was also pointed out by H. L. Mitchell, one of the founders of the Southern Tenant Farmers Union, in his autobiography, Mean Things Happening in This Land. He describes what this life was like. For a sharecropper, the day started before dawn. The plantation bell was the first sound he heard upon awakening. His wife was soon getting a fire going in the cook stove. A cup of cheap coffee started the day off. She put biscuits in the oven to be eaten with molasses and fat back meat by the adults. There was cornmeal mush for the young ones. First, the man would go to the plantation barn where the hostler assigned a mule to him. He harnessed it and was in the cotton field before sun was up. The day's work was well underway by sunrise, and it didn't end until after sundown. The plantation riding boss would be in the field supervising the cropper's work. In addition to seeing to it that each sharecropper was in the field and plowing his rows straight, the rider represented the law to both black and white sharecroppers alike. He replaced the slave driver of pre-Civil War days. The emancipation of the slaves put both black and white, poor landless people, to sharecropping, a new form of slavery. Normally, the work on the cotton plantations was well underway by March 1st. The land was first broken, then harrowed, and the rows were laid out for planting the cottonseed by the time the frost was out of the ground. March 1st was Furnish Day, when the company store opened its doors to the sharecroppers to take on credit. Each family was entitled to draw its groceries and other supplies. There was a credit limit based on $1 per month for each acre in cotton the cropper was to cultivate.
Sample complete. Ready to continue?